July 28, 1985, I'm Mark Wagler, talking with Halsey Reinhart and his family at their home in Rockbridge. This is tape 3, side 1. I think I said that before. Well, are there any good stories about your courtship, Halsey? Any that come to mind? What about the purse? We never did get to that one.
Well, of course, every young driver has the inclination to take the corner a little faster the next time he goes around. And this time, we went around so fast that Gina's purse fell out, fell open. And what happened? I reached for it?
No, it was open. I was, on my lap. You went around the corner like that, and my, everything went all over the front seat, the car, all over the place.
Yeah, you know,
I don't remember much more than that.
I don't remember.
I don't know if the girls remember that. Because we just talked about when we went around that corner or what. I don't
know. So, any other courtship stories that come to mind? Otherwise, I'll let you plant those and see what grows.
Well, I don't think of any.
It was a very ordinary time.
But it's a, you know, it's an important time of one's life. Now, what's the order, the birth order of your daughters? You remember the birth years?
Katie is the oldest. She was born in 1940, about 4 months after our house burned.
This is an interesting point, is of our house burning. We lived here, and we were running the store, but there was no house at the store. It had just been a filling station enlarged to be a small country store. And we ran from this side to the store, and my father and mother ran from across the road to the store, and somebody had to be taking care of the store all the time. But the house that we lived in is the house I have painted in the picture back of you on the wall. And it was old. In fact, my grandfather had come home from the Civil War and built that house among the trees over here. And then after it supposedly had served its lifetime, he moved that house over here and made another house of it and built another addition onto his house over there in place of it. Then he rebuilt this over here, and this was the house that we lived in. It was a part of the old original house that had been there, and it was cold. It was terribly cold. It had no speck of insulation anywhere, and the wall under it was falling away. And to say that it was cold. And we were having a Sunday school party on the 27th of January in 1940. And we had a house full of kids and, yeah, about 15 young people here. And I remember it had been such a cold day, and we were anticipating this, and I had fired the old parlor heater all day in order to try to warm the house up enough so that it would be reasonable to have company that night. And I was still firing the stove that night, burning it hard. One of these old chimneys that sat on a bracket, you know, up on the wall side, and probably was the original chimney in the house, and had probably been moved when the house was moved, and hard to tell how many times in its history it had burned out and cracked. And somebody said, "Gee, it's getting brown up there by your chimney." And I said, "Well, smart answer. I'll go upstairs. Maybe the house was on fire." And I walked up the head of the stairway, and boy, the house was on fire. The whole top was just burning all the way out, and then it was burning back into the floor. And I grabbed two things. One thing, I had bought a new milking machine up to the farm, and it sat there. And I picked up the milker and threw it out the upstairs window and grabbed a box at the top of the stairs and rushed downstairs. We told everybody to take the furniture they were sitting in and run.
The box contained Christmas tree decorations.
Yeah, I was in the doghouse when we found out that all of our wedding presents had burned up, and I'd brought down a box full of Christmas tree decorations. But I remember of our entire lifetime, I think that was the lowest time we experienced, because our piano sat out in the snow, and all of our furniture just sat around in the snow. There were no fire departments. Nobody came except a few of the neighbors, and there was nothing to do. Only just let it burn down, and it was down, and the old chimney sat up by itself all alone. The house had fallen away from it, and everything that we owned sat out in the snow. Then we had to go over to my father and mother's, and their house was cold, and I don't remember where we slept.
Day bed
in the dining room, and we finished out what was the rest of the night from that, and that was a very, very low time.
And we lived with them from January until in May. By that time, we had built the house at the store, the house around the store, and raised the roof and everything. We moved in 2 weeks before Katie was born, in June. We lived there then until after Carol was born. Carol was 6 months old when we moved to the farm.
What year was that?
That was 1945.
45, she was born?
Mm-hmm.
For 5 years?
Yeah, almost 5 years. Moved in February before it was born.
Were your children born at home? Or?
No,
in the Richland Hospital.
It was special at the Richland County, Richland Hospital, when Katie was born. $40. And that included the delivery room, 10 days in the hospital, and care of the mother and baby, both, all for $40.
I don't know, Mark, whether they ran this special in the paper 9 months before or not.
I always think of myself as a $40 special.
Stayed in the hospital 9 days. That happened to be the ninth day came on Sunday, so I went home. And then when Carol was born in 1944, I stayed in the hospital.
Well, she was born in 44.
She was born in 44, and we moved to the farm then 6 months later. Which would be born. And I stayed the whole 10 days.
My experience with Katie's birth, though, is I sat back there in the little waiting room, and the radio was going on, and it was raining. It was just one of these rains that just come down, like that. It was really raining outside. Hard, but not furiously, and no thunder and lightning. I remember the sound and the smell of that rain as it came in, and the radio was going, and Il Duce was marching the Italian army into Ethiopia. And this was the pro-runner of the World War II. This was the first act.
And while I was in the hospital, Paris was taken. I remember hearing that on the radio. Then when I was in the hospital.
Well, that wasn't for that birth.
Then when I was in the hospital when Carol was born in 1944, 4 years later, was when Paris was liberated. It just happened that I heard both when Paris was taken and when Paris was liberated while I was in the hospital two different times. And then after Carol was born in 1948, 4 years later, Marilyn was born. We were living in the farm. And in 1960, Janice was born.
I think.
Cold winter night, we were doing the tax roll, off of the town clerk, and we had to finish proofreading the tax roll before I went to the hospital. And so we finished at about 11 o'clock, I think, and she was born about 2.
So. Had to get tax roll done.
Yeah, we got that done.
I think that I can say I was the last person in this family born before penicillin. And that is a really landmark in human history, if you really think about it, because I'm the last person in this family that will remember scarlet fever epidemic. We talked about that the other day, the quarantining, because by 1945, they were using penicillin. And what a difference that made in how much time you stayed in the hospital having a baby. And almost anything that involved your biological system the development of antibiotics changed human history. But I can remember when the Clarks got scarlet fever and they had to burn all their books and all their curtains.
And quarantine 6 weeks.
Big signs on how terrifying that was. And I, when Colin had to write a theme, I said, you can introduce it by saying that if my mother had been born 10 years earlier, perhaps I would not be here, because the possibility of people surviving before antibiotics was not half as great as after we could fight infection. I remember hearing the radio. One of my very first memories is the radio when the truce was signed in Europe, and I must have been 4 years old. And
well,
hearing the bells and the people in the streets.
You were just very learning to talk, I think, when they were declaring war on after Pearl Harbor. And I remember her sitting in the kitchen at the office door, and as they would call the roll of the senators, she'd imitate them. She'd say, Maine votes yes, or whatever they said. I don't know. But she would imitate them. So she helped to declare war.
I think this is one of the things that I might remember about my grandfather that was an interesting story. Is I was just a little boy at the beginning of World War I. My grandpa had been in the Civil War. And grandpa would read me the newspapers. And the stories in the newspapers were the stories of the German dirigibles flying over London, and Grandpa was so angry. He thought such an inhumane way of conducting warfare, and was so angry at the Bush, the Germans, because they would take this terrible way of bombing an open city, that he couldn't just believe this after having had his experiences with the Civil War.
I was sitting at my desk a few months ago, within the last few months, when they were reliving the end of World War II. And I remember one day they were playing a recording from 1944, a recording of the people of France in the street, and they were singing Pomp and Circumstance.
Well, that's Marseillaise.
Marseillaise, yes, okay. And I was thinking how interesting, because that was one of my first memories, was hearing that on the radio. And here I was in the middle of Abbott Laboratories, in the middle of a routine day, hearing this recording of the same. That is really my first memory. I remember hearing the bells and hearing the people and having it interpreted for me, the joy that people felt at peace. And that's really been a strong memory for me.
I remember World War I, the experience of...
Okay.
Oh, my one of my memories, of course, was Grandpa, and how tremendously angry he was at the Germans. But seeing my first airplane, and we lived at the house at the farm, and we heard this roaring in the sky. And we came out, and there was a squadron of four, I suppose, Jennies, flew across the bottom of the valley. And they were warplanes. Or they were the first, they were the planes of the World War I. And this, I so impressed on me to see those airplanes, and to think my dad and mother told me that there were men in those airplanes flying across the valley. Oh, yes. At World War I, when the gas attacks came on the Western Front, and we had to supply gas masks to our soldiers. Of course, the Germans lost their own battle with their own gases, because they didn't recognize the fact that they were facing the prevailing westerly winds. And they dropped the gas canisters and the winds blew the gas back on the Germans until it was much more effective against themselves than it was against the enemy. But we had to have gas masks, thinking that every soldier had to be prepared with a gas mask. and the charcoal made from nutshells is the absorbent charcoal that's used in the canisters that absorb that mustard gas as it was used at that time. So if you were patriotic, you cracked nuts and saved the shells. What you did with the meats was your own business, but you saved the shells. And all summer, Grandma and I had cracked nuts. And we had nut bread and nut cake, and boy, we had lots of nuts to eat that summer. But we kept saving these, and we had a big bag. I can still see it was a paper bag about that big. And down on the corner of Keegan's drugstore was a barrel. And people were supposed to come in and contribute their nutshells to that particular barrel to send the nutshells to the factory where they would make them into charcoal, put them into the canisters to send the gas mask. On the 11th of November, foggy, hazy day, about 9 o'clock in the morning, Grandma and I took our bag of nutshells and patriotically deposited them in the barrel. At 11 o'clock, the war was over. They were just waiting for that bag of nutshells.
I remember when the Second World War was over, Barbara Jewell was at our place. And I heard on the radio that they just signed a treaty with Japan in August, right after the bombing. And I called up to the girls and I said, the war is over. And here came Barbara and Katie down the steps. And Barbara just said, the war is over, the war is over. She was so excited. And I don't remember much after that, except we talked to Donna and to Barbara's parents, and we went and had a picnic that night.
Continuing on from throwing the bag of nutshells in, we came home from town from 9 o'clock, and at 11 o'clock, the whistles began to blow.
Really?
After all these years, I might break down at this point, because it was such an emotional point for everybody that the war is over.
The war to end all wars.
The war to end all wars. And Dad had gone squirrel hunting. And during the war, they made black powder shotgun shells. That was the only thing. I got two or three of those old black powder shells laying around yet. I don't suppose they would go off. But anyway, Dad had about a dozen of them with him, and they were poor manufacture. He'd already snapped them in the gun once, and they hadn't gone. So he was carrying along his pocket thinking, next time, maybe they will go. And he got back as far as the Natural Bridge, right on top of the rock from the Natural Bridge. And the whistles and the church bells, we could hear them from Richland Center, and everybody knew that the war was over. So Dad started shooting. And I can hear that sound just as clearly as if it was today. Boom, 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 boom. Seven shots, and they all went. Every black powder shell went. Yeah.
Oh, that's just a wonderful story.
I have another story. You know, I like those stories of Grandpa because my memory is not wonderful of Grandpa because he was older and, you know, when Janice was moving the other day, I told this story to my class too. We were getting ready to put all of her belongings in boxes, and I had gone over to spend the night with my sister to help her get ready to move to a house that would be all her own, her and Andrew's house. And it wasn't a sad time, really, but it was a poignant time that I wanted to share with her. And I unloaded all her cabinets and put them in boxes, and I wiped down all the counters, and we were slowly kind of closing up her life in that house. And we were in the living room, and we came upon this beautiful bronze Art Deco girl with a skirt blowing in the wind, a heavy treasured piece that once had a thermometer going down the center. Just a lovely thing. Very classic for a period of time, and in a romantic kind of a treasure that somebody once bought. It's shining, and it looks like gold, and it's very heavy, and it's a beautiful girl. And I said, gee, you got that from Grandma, didn't you? And she said, I'm so glad I have it because do you know the story of this girl? And I said, no. She said, well, this is a gift that Grandpa Reinhardt bought for his mother-in-law. And when he gave it to her, they laughed at him and they made fun of him and they treated it as being a silly gift. And he was so embarrassed and so hurt by that he never bought another gift for anybody until one day when he took Janice to town and she was very young, maybe 3 or 4 years old, and he bought her a yellow sweater. And that's such a nice story. Because it does say that where I saw him as manipulative and always trying to get me to feed the chickens corn or carry a pail of this or that somewhere or pull mustard and always thinking that I didn't work hard.
Yellow rugged.
That he was a very sensitive person who had at one time really had some of that kindness stomped out of him here and there. And that yellow sweater for Janice is a real symbol of how he eventually at least came to trust his granddaughters as being safe to his love.
I remember a story of my cousin who was in the World War and right up marching toward the front lines and would have surely been engaged in battle by another 24 hours. And they marched all afternoon toward the front, and with the anxiety of knowing and seeing them bringing back people badly crippled and bodies dead and seeing the guns and hearing the flash, and at about 6 a.m. they were awakened and alerted to march, and instead of marching forward they marched back.
Because the war was over?
The war was over.
Wow.
And they didn't know it, see, until 11 o'clock when it was actually signed.
They're losing war at that point.
Well, no, but they couldn't understand why. They were expecting to be told to march forward and they were told to march back.
Who was there?
Lynn Wynell.
You had a lot of friends who went to the war.
Another story of the war that is one that's a real tearjerker. Earl Reinhardt was a truck driver, and then he was in charge of a pumping station. And I guess he was in charge of the pumping station before he was then transferred to a truck driver. But anyway, you have heard of the Battle of Bellevue Woods. And Earl said that for 5 or 6 days, they hauled up cannon and ammunition and put it at the outside of that woods. And the Germans were entrenched in that woods just so deeply they didn't think there would be any possibility of routing them out of there. And they lined up 4,800 cannon around that woods, and they started shelling, and it was just a continual blasting of artillery into that woods for hours, and eventually the white flag came up, and when they surrendered, Earl said you could cry. Whenever you thought of it, there were old men leading 13-year-old boys. There were fellows with arms shot off. There were the most in the German army. What was left of it? He said the most tragic thing he had ever seen in his life were that group of Germans when they came out of the woods. And yet they had pounded them for 24 hours with all those cannon.
World War
I
or World War
I? World War I. Battle of Bellevue Woods.
Yeah. Tell a story about the demonstration here recently about Weren't you all involved in this past year in town?
Candlelight
March. Well, I think there's a story before that, because I think the story of how you began to have to move away from your peers, which started back when Carol was in college, really. Well, before that, when Carol was in college even, and Carol and Phil began to be interested in at that time, civil rights, and go to Selma and so on, and that was the beginning of having to choose what every parent should have to choose, to follow their children in idealism or to go with their peers. And I think that was a real strong hard thing for you. The speech club people weren't sure that they understood it. And from that civil rights thing, then we went on to the Vietnam.
And at the time of the first march that also was involved, the girls came home from college for Christmas vacation, and with some other kids from various other colleges, got together and organized protest march.
Peace march.
A peace march, really, down through
Christmas Eve.
Christmas Eve.
And of course, we had been, they made posters at our place, and with the peace sign on, stop the war, and stop the bombing, all kinds of things against the Vietnam War. And they wanted to have us in one of the churches in town, that would be the church that we went to, and the board said no, they didn't want me. So they went out to the community building, and then they asked Hoss if he'd speak, and he had been teaching a Sunday school class and talking about how wrong the Vietnam War was. So then he had to come through, and so he did have to speak at this. It was a very unpopular subject.
How many people were there?
Well, there were probably a dozen from the college, and another dozen from kids home from college. Yeah, of local people. Not a lousy minister stuck his head up.
One of the ministers had been asked to come and give an invocation or do a prayer, and he says he forgot. He was shoveling snow, and he forgot.
You know where that story begins? Oh, well, it begins in lots of places, but one of the places it begins. Remember when I went to college and I would write home some things that I was studying, and I remember you wrote and said, well, I hope they're not going to make a Democrat out of you.
Oh, that must have been a tongue-in-cheek remark.
Well, you were really quite concerned. I was taking
class. Yeah, I was in the Republican Party and helped recruit Joe McCarthy.
Well, you didn't help. You just helped him get elected.
Yeah, well, Joe was a...
He's already recruited.
Joe was a very promising young county judge who looked like he had lots of possibilities from over in Fond du Lac County. And the young Republicans decided to promote Joe McCarthy, and they pushed him, and I was, president of the Young Republican Club? Yeah, and gee, I worked my head off trying to get Joe McCarthy elected.
And while the girls were doing all this peace work and everything, they subscribed to the New Republic for us. It was about as far left as you could get. We got our name on all the lists of things subverting people. You got a lot of strange literature for a while.
Which you read.
Well, we've read enough of it, I guess. But both Carol and Marilyn were in the march in Washington when they arrested all these kids, all the college kids, and put them behind.
When Nixon refused to put out to the golf course.
He was watching a ball game, football game, in the fall. And then Marilyn was back, because Carol was there too, but she came to Boston from New York. When they carried the name of a soldier in Vietnam, and they carried caskets and went past the white.
And recited the name as they went by.
Read the name off as they went, and it was in the rain. But they got quite involved. And then at the time Martin Luther King's assassination, Marilyn and her boyfriend at that time went up in Chicago and handed out food down at the stock pavilion area, stockyards. And So the girls were in college at the time when all this unrest was going on. Janet was, she was a senior, or a freshman, I think, at the time of the march in Washington. But I don't know if we told her she couldn't go, but she used that as an excuse not to go. But she stayed at home at Naperville, and they staged some marches in Naperville to show their support for the kids that had gone. So they were really involved. When Katie was in college, college was not involved in things. Mm-hmm. I went to visit her right first, and it just seemed like a sort of a extension of high school. You know, they really weren't involved except just at their own little group. And probably the most important thing was whether or not they should have campus church or should go to the little churches.
Well, I went to North Lentor College just after the discussion about whether they should allow dancing on campus and whether they should kick people out of the school who went to restaurants where they served alcohol. Mm-hmm. So from there in 1958 to when Carol was there in 1964 was a big jump, and a lot happened in that time.
And then even more so by the time Janice came, they had dropped their chaplaincy program and didn't require kids to go to the chapel.
What school is this?
North Central College at Naperville, at United Methodist College. Now it was a evangelical United Methodist.
Tell me what you remember though about the time before people knew that Vietnam, because I remember for myself, I did not oppose the Vietnam War early on.
I can remember and Chuck saying, well, you can't pick your wars.
I remember that we felt that these kids were a little off in left field. And yet, slowly the country came to it. And certainly you came to the sense of what was going on before your peers. And so it was kind of a lonely time. Milford and Don Whedon and all those people, I don't know if they ever really came back. The Vietnam War was a bad thing.
No, they still think that we should have just gone in there and driven them back to the Stone Age. That was they think we should have used the atomic bomb on them. And
the speech club got to be pretty unpleasant.
Yes, it did. We had a lot of good...
We had to tongue a lot.
What?
We had to bite our tongues.
Well, we still do.
And stayed home.
We had a speech club.
Oh, that you should have done.
There was a group of us that got together. There was one of the fellows was going to run for the assembly. So they were going to help him in giving speeches. So they organized a speech club. We weren't in it at that time. And they would get together, and in order to sharpen his skills in talking, they answered roll call with a joke. Everybody had to tell a joke. And that gave him a lot of stories. Well, then they would each one give a speech about something, but during the time that Don was running, they worked on his platform with all issues and things in the country. He was running against Vernon Thompson, so he had to be pretty good, you know. And he was defeated. And then we joined the club about the time Carol was born, I guess. And we very faithfully, every time, would get our joke ready to tell, and then we would each one have a speech tonight, about a 3 or 4 minute speech. You could choose any subject you wanted. So we had some really good speeches, and sometimes they got quite political. And then finally it sort of digressed into where you told the jokes, and maybe you'd have 3 or 4 speeches, and maybe finally got to it, just we got together and talked. But as we got, as the others...
One of the things we did once, Mark, took a course.
That wasn't this group.
No, took a correspondence course from the university. The group, and then one of the fellows, Cameron Gillingham, he did all the legwork. He did all the wrote the tests, and he got the credit. And he did go on to the university and use the credit. But each time, one of us would be selected as the teacher to have to teach that particular subject, particular chapter of the. And it was a course in great powers and political science. Great powers and world politics was the name of the course. And then during the time, see, we were connected with the university. And during the time, they sent us out 4 professors from the University of Wisconsin. This was a new experiment to see how it was working out. And they sent us out Llewellyn Van Kooken, who was one of the guys who had written the United Nations Charter. And was really you know, one of the top dogs in the whole political picture at that time. And they sent us out a very liberal Democrat. I remember who, I can't remember his name, but boy, some of those fellows were really challenged by this liberal Democrat who came out and talked to our class.
And one time, one fellow came out who was a very young professor, and he talked to me back to Madison by 10 o'clock.
By midnight, we were just getting started.
We were still going strong at midnight, and he was just in there asking questions, talking to us, and finding out. Because he thought people out in the rural area were country bumpkins. But he we had boned out and we're ready to learn.
And we had some,
and we always took the kids with us.
Yeah, always took the kids.
All four of them, drag them out and drag them back home, and so they got exposed.
We had about three nights on the League of Nations, and one man had made himself particularly. This was his subject that he had studied, Lauren. Aldine's husband, Lauren Damon, had studied very carefully, and he was the one who presented the.
And then we studied the UN, so that we had two people from the UN systems of world peace, which was very interesting.
So we've done a lot of self-study. We've taken at least four classes, haven't we, at college?
I think there's stories in that, because I think about that education is certainly a theme in this family. And early stories is Grandma.
And it goes clear back to Grandma and her sisters. Uh-huh.
And you're sitting around reading at night.
Yeah, this is one of the things that happened when I was a little boy. There were no radios and no televisions. Grandpa and Grandma were old and lived across the road, and we lived here in the house that's in the picture. And when dusk would come, we'd go over and they had the Aladdin lamp. Do you know what an Aladdin lamp is? It has the incandescent filament that you light the mantle, that you have to heat up, and then you can turn it up. And each one of us would read a chapter out of the books. And we always had a current bestseller, all of James Oliver Curwood's. Do you recognize James Oliver Curwood? He wrote The Stories of the North of Alaska, and the Yukon, and of course Zane Grey, all of Zane Grey's books, Helen Stratton Porter, Harold Bell Wright. One book that I particularly remember of Harold Bell Wright, and it had an effect on my being a little bit on the radical side all my life, was called Acres of Wheat, and it dealt with the IWW. Do you recognize the International Workers of the World, and the organization of the laborers in the great wheat fields out in Washington and Oregon, and how they would set the wheat fields on fire, and they would make little bombs out of fluorescent materials, which would, you could take them out when it was wet and scatter them all around in the wheat fields, and they wouldn't ignite until it got so dry. And then they would light the acres of the wheat would burn. Another one of the books that we read at that time was The Mine with the Iron Door, which was Harold Bell Wright's. Let's see if I can remember any other book. The Keeper of the Bees. Oh, Gene Stratton Porter wrote a beautiful story of the Keeper of the Bees, old man, so much like Mr. Hatch, who was a beekeeper and a little girl that was his friend. It was,
coping. What was Grandma Reinhardt's relationship with Chautauqua? Because I think I've heard her talk about Chautauqua.
Well, just the fact going to the Chautauqua when it was Richland Center and Jim, Brian. William Jennings Bryan was at Richland Center speaking at the Chautauqua at one time.
So that travel then. Mm-hmm. And then the other, I guess I think in that whole line, I think of you reading together. And then I think of your stories of the wireless, the first radio.
Oh, that was an interesting time. Yeah, the first indications were that there were wireless. Somebody said that Hugh McNally. What?
Did you have
one? I'll stay here, I guess. Oh, that Hugh McNally had a wireless telephone. It was almost impossible to imagine. You know, and you visualize it, you'd see a telephone sitting on the wall with no wires to it. Gee, it's a wireless telephone. What does that mean? Well, then we said, no, he has a radio. It's a radio. Well, I suppose it probably was a crystal set. I don't know. It may have been a one-tube super heterodyne. Then Oscar Henry also had a radio that he had built in a little garage down across from the cemetery. He was a garageman, and he somewhere or other. And so we went down to Oscar Henry's one night, and it had strength enough to support three sets of earphones. And it took up the whole wall of dials. And there were A battery, B battery, C batteries, and D batteries. And such an intricate bunch of wires, and they all went up there. And here were these dials, and rather than they were condensers, and rather than be synchronized, you know, you turn one and they all turn together, you'd have to adjust this one, and then you'd have to adjust that one. And right in the middle of it, it'd go, squeak! And so you think, well, that sounds like it might be the middle one. And you'd turn the middle one just a little bit, and your squeak would go. And you could get a WLS, Sears and Roebuck, World's Largest Store, WLS, World's Largest Store, Sears and Roebuck Company in Chicago. Henry Field Seed Company at Waterloo, Iowa. Oh, let's see. You could get KDKA Pittsburgh. Oh, and you could get WKDA Denver. You could get about four stations. There were no stations at Milwaukee, no stations at Madison that were broadcasting yet. And you had to have earphones in order to hear it. Well, then in 1928, by 1928...
Could you say that again? You had to have earphones?
You had to have earphones in order to hear it. But by 1928, Grandma, who was well off, as any good Social Security person is now, because she had Grandpa's pension from the Civil War. She was a widow, and the widow's got a pretty good pension, which I think was $35 a month. And Grandma was very well off, but Grandma saved her $35 a month, and she bought a $125 Crosley radio. And the Crosley had a loudspeaker, a cone. Not a horn, but a cone speaker, which was greatly improvement over the old horn speaker that the other radios had had. And Charlie Strang, who was the father of Holly Strang, who has Strang Electric now, brought it out one evening, and he set it up, and then he climbed up on the house, and he hooked up the antenna. I can remember seeing him walk down the going straight to the peak of the roof in the evening, and then he almost dark, and he brought it in and turned it on. And the first thing that we heard, the thing that Grandma had been out to hear more than anything else, was the fact that Herbert Hoover had defeated Al Smith for the presidency. So that must have been a 1928 period. And I remember how excited we were that good old WASP, white Protestant, Herbert Hoover had defeated that terrible Catholic, Al Smith, which was really the issue. More, it was an issue of Republican or Democrat, but Al Smith was the first Catholic that had dared to raise his head and even aspire toward the presidency of the United States. But he lost it, and he lost it to Herbert Hoover. And, of course, then Hoover inherited such a catastrophe in the 1929 stock market crash and the depression that followed there.
And then they got the first television in our family, and we would go down there. I remember watching television, Jackie Gleason, My Honeymooners, Although, then it was more snow than anything else.
Uh-huh.
But one more time, it was sort of like the family hearth.
Yeah, isn't that true? We had the reading of the books that brought us together. And then we had the radio that brought us together. And then television. I mean, I remember how really disappointed Dad was when we bought a television. Not that he didn't want us to have a television, but it kept us from coming to their house every night.
And our family.
Yeah, it kept us from bringing the family together. And they watched their television and we watched our television. Ordinarily, while we'd just hurry up with the milking in order to get down to my dad's to watch his television.
That was 1956.
I suppose.
And, well, I think that's a story, too, because for me, that was an important time. 1956 is September, October, because I remember I came down to the barn, and there are a lot of stories about my boyfriends we haven't told. Bob Beatty is certainly an important chapter in this family, and all the times he got stuck in the driveway in the mud puddle. But when he went away to college, North Central College, one more time, and I wanted to go and visit him for homecoming. When I think about it now, I was only 16 years old, and I remember I came to the barn, and you were milking cows, and I said I wanted to go visit Bob at the college. And I remember you said, well, I just don't know what to say, because I'm just afraid if you go down there, you're going to want to go to college. And I just don't see how we can afford to send you to college.
I don't remember that. That's very accurate, Katie, because I had always known and felt that you would go to college.
I think that you were saying, I don't know how we're going to afford to send you to that college.
I think probably that's what I was saying.
But that was...
I had always expected La Crosse or Platteville or...
So anyway, I remember I sewed a black felt skirt and a black scoop neck blouse and a new gray flannel suit, and I sewed all those things, pants, jacket, skirt, top, and went off to visit Bob Beatty when I was 16 years old at North Central College the same weekend that we got television.
Oh.
1957.
Seven.
The fall of 57. And before that, we had not had television at all. We didn't have a telephone until I was 10 or 11.
Having a telephone was a rather humorous thing. You had to make your application months and months and months ahead to get a line extension. And we had had our application in for a long time. And we had a big high water. And here come a car driving through the high water. Driving, and we thought, what kind of a situation would bring anybody out into driving this high water? And this guy drove in our driveway, and the water was running down the center of our barnyard, and it was clear to the running board. And this guy came across, and he said, "I just came up to tell you that your application for a telephone has been reviewed, and we'll be able to bring you one in about 3 months."
Thank you, Mother Bell.
Thank you, Ma Bell. Yeah.
It's really interesting. You were talking about reading books, radio, and television, family heart, but then back before reading books, there must have been a time in the family when there was a time of telling stories as a basic way of gathering.
Yes, there always was. That was always a part of it, especially with Grandpa. Grandpa was a storyteller, but I remember so little. If I could have known what life would demand, I could have written so many things down that Grandpa could have told me. But they all were lost. You have only the impressions.
I think I have a lot of good stories about Grandma and Grandpa too, but particularly Grandma, because I was the oldest and the first, and she really doted on that.
Uh-huh.
And how she taught me to make potato soup, and that was the the event to stay all night with Grandma and make potato soup. And I remember even being 16 and 17, going down there and using her treadle sewing machine that she did also taught me to sew. She really took seriously that teaching function of teaching us, especially me, to sew, to cook. I remember the year that we went hunting for nuts. We would climb way high on these hills to get butternuts and bring them back. That's when I was in grade school. She seemed to really like that.
You know, we have, Mark, we have movies clear back until Katie was 6 months old. And we haven't seen them for a long time. They're in a box, and I hope they're, some of them are on big reels. Yeah, I guess they're usable yet. We, in the wintertime when everybody's home, why, we usually get some out and show them. And I suppose I have $1,000 in films, and we just have them labeled 1957, 1958, 1959, and they're still on their little reels in their little baseboard boxes. But we have all those going clear back to when Katie was 6 months old. Just a nice kind of history to have.
You know, it's very easy for me to spend time with Adam this weekend. It feels natural and comfortable. Perish the thought that I feel like a grandmother, but in essence, he needs a grandmother figure, and I guess I'll be it. My sister has a stepson now.
This boy.
13, Adam, who was with us, and it's a big shock. Suddenly find yourself the grandmother of a 13-year-old who's taller than you are. However, it's been a nice thing to have.
Your daughter has a stepson. You said your sister.
Oh, my daughter. I'm sorry. I do get those confused. My daughter. And so Adam and I have spent some time together doing various things, but I remember time spent with my grandmother where she really did take the time to introduce me to things that only she could introduce me to. Going nut picking, sewing on a treadle sewing machine, making potato soup. And the other memory I guess I have is of Grandpa and Grandma Truesdell and the companionship that they had set a really strong model for men and women getting along together and being friends, because that was, you'd wake up there in the morning and hear them downstairs doing their devotions together or just visiting. And that they really had a companionable, happy, peaceful life together, that they were willing to include me in. That's a good model.
I'm just aware you said that